Our second presentation of the morning is Fairy Tales and the Unconscious Scripts That We Live By by Chelsea Wakefield. Chelsea, by trade, is a social worker and therapist and dream worker and spiritual guide and director. She's a graduate of our Spiritual Direction program and is on the faculty, teaches there, and teaches in our dream program also. And she has come to this area of the country via California, and she moved from California to our backyard here, and we didn't know each other till then, and it's a wonderful friendship, and she's as talented as they come. Chelsea.
Today I'm going to talk to you about fairy tales and how the unconscious imprints of these early stories impact our adult lives, how the characters and themes of these archetypal tales relate to dream work. I rediscovered fairy tales and the magical importance of childhood stories when I began to read bedtime stories to my son. As he sat cuddled within the circle of my arms, I read him stories of magical lamps and carpets, clever boys who prevailed over giants, frogs that became princes, foolish kings and jealous queens, dark forests filled with danger and adventure, enchantments that could only be broken by love, and girls who would become queen if only they could find the right pair of shoes. I have fond memories of him acting out these stories in his play and checking under the bridge of a nearby park to make sure the troll was not there that day. He was 4 years old when I became deeply interested in Jungian psychology, and I recognized that my son and I were journeying through the archetypal realm as surely as if we were doing dream work. It was as if I had re-entered that magical realm with eyes and ears for their deeper meaning. Over those story years, we encountered hundreds of characters and places and plots, and I watched his little psyche absorb the messages of all those tales. Jung loved fairy tales, as did his successor, Marie-Louise von Franz, who devoted a good portion of her life to this representation of the collective unconscious. Myths tell us about the dominant values of the culture in which we are created. Both myths and fairy tales teach us about life, but fairy tales tend to be more subversive. They address that which is unjust, oppressed, and inexplicable, but common to the human condition. Fairy tales explore passages of human development and many aspects of human relationship. They grapple with irony, paradox, and turn things upside down, inviting us to consider alternative points of view. In olden days, fairy tales were told mostly by women around the fire during the winter months, or at festivals, perhaps after much wine had been drunk. Some of my friends recall old tales told in the lap of their grandmothers or by their mothers as they ironed, cooked, or put them to bed. The stories we were told as children are deeply embedded in both our conscious memory and resonating in the unconscious. And as in dreams, all characters in the fairy tale represent a different aspect of the psyche. Fairy tales, Bible stories, and even family legend become templates for character development and the expectations of life. They lay out who is good and bad, what is safe and dangerous, who wins, who loses. Much of our unconscious adult scripts are based on these lessons learned in childhood. I am fond of asking people what their favorite childhood story was. What was yours? What character did you love best? What part did they play? Hero? Villain? Misunderstood one or vulnerable one? How did they overcome their challenges? What lessons did you learn from the story? How did this story shape your hopes and expectations for the future? And has the fairy tale delivered its promise? I have found these to be fertile questions. It can be quite enlightening to service the degree of expectation that we hold for the fulfillment of these early promises and warnings. Bringing this material into consciousness can uncover some interesting sources of distorted expectations about life. But the divine director is always inviting us into a larger story. Every night on the stage of our inner world, Our dreams open up new possibilities for healing, hope, and creative living. The scope of fairy tales is vast. Most of us are familiar with the favorites from childhood, but there are also fairy tales that tell us a bit about what happens in the happily ever after part. Alan Chinnan has written several collections of fairy tales about marriage and midlife, and a wonderful collection just for men called Beyond the Hero. For women who wish to delve deeper into this topic, I would recommend Joan Gould's wonderful work called Spinning Straw into Gold, and perhaps Clarissa Pinkola Estes' Women Who Run with the Wolves. Today I've picked out a few well-known fairy tales and a few lesser-known tales that address both women's and men's journey through life. You remember Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty, known in the Grimm collection as Briar Rose. She is the girl who lived under a terrible curse that on her 16th birthday, she would prick her finger on a spindle and fall asleep for 100 years. Her father tried his best to keep her protected from this inevitable fate by banishing every spinning wheel in the land. But as will happen, in the time of her awakening womanhood, the adolescent girl began to explore forbidden territory. In a distant room of the castle, she encounters a mysterious old woman and the last remaining spinning wheel in the land. Fascinated, she reaches out to grasp the spindle, pricks her finger, and the entire kingdom goes unconscious. In the more cleaned-up Disney version, 100 years pass, and finally a handsome and impetuous prince scales the bramble-covered walls of the castle and awakens her with a kiss. Women have deeply internalized this story, and it is the basis for one of our greatest maladies. Even in 2009, on some unconscious level, many of us still believe that our problems would be solved if only our prince would come along. As I listen to women sigh and long for a better choice of lovers, the love that is offered them often sounds like refrigerator leftovers the second night in a row. We don't want ordinary love. We want the fairy tale version. The more movies we see and the more Oprah we watch, the more dissatisfied we get. As Mama Cass once sang, worn out phrases and longing gazes won't win a girl's heart anymore. If you love her, you must send her somewhere where she's never been before. We want to be swept off of our feet. An ordinary man lacks the princely flourish. And so we wait in a state of suspended animation. To borrow from another fairy tale, we long for the magic of love to transform us from ordinary cinder girls to beautiful princesses. We have not been taught to find our own inner flame, and so we wait for him to come along and light our fire. Some women spend their entire lives trying to figure out how to make themselves desirable enough to win some sought-after prince, and once won, how to remain youthful and enchanting enough to hold him. They live in a state of perpetual anxiety, thus the billion-dollar fashion, perfume, and cosmetics industry, and the booming industry of plastic surgery. Jungian analyst Paula Jung Eisendrath has written several books on women's development and the topic of women and desire. She writes, "The compulsion to be desired and desirable undermines self-direction, self-confidence, and self-determination in women from adolescence through old age in all our roles, from daughter to mother, from lover to wife, from student to worker or leader, whether or not the affliction is conscious. Many of our early fairy tales center around the desirable young princess or maiden. Women want to be wanted, because it gives us a sense of value and power, but it is borrowed power, dependent on meeting the ideals of those around us. It does not spring from within us, and so we are ever anxious. We try to be nice, good, attractive, legitimate, and worthy based on someone else's appraisal. Many of us do not know what we actually think, feel, or desire for ourselves. We look to others to tell us and to validate us. Like the little match girl, if we are ordinary people, We fear that our own little flame could never be enough to warm or sustain us. You would think that with all the consciousness work of the women's movement that we would have moved beyond this, but I find the generation of girls coming up even more entrapped in image consciousness than my own generation. When our value is based on being wanted, needed, or desirable, every woman in this room is condemned to become a dark queen as we age. Envy, jealousy, competition, and fear will be our constant companions as we ask the mirror on the wall if we are still fair enough to have value. How do we transcend the dark queen complex? We must learn to anchor our value in our archetypal depths rather than in the fragile, reflected sense of self we receive from others. We must develop a core sense of self and learn to navigate by our own inner lights. Dreamwork helps us to do this. The archetypal realm where dreams are born is an inexhaustible pantry filled with rich and nourishing food for all of us. It is in this realm that we come in contact with our own sacred fire, the ground of our being, the spirit that lifts us and connects us to a story beyond our petty concerns. A woman transcends the curse of the dark queen by getting into her own soul stream and following the flow of that current to what gives her life meaning beyond the reflection of others. When you are passionately engaged in your own fulfilling endeavors, comparing yourself to others becomes ridiculous. Let's return to Sleeping Beauty and look at this story through Jungian eyes. If all characters in the tale are aspects of our own psyches, what is this telling us about being a woman? It certainly is telling us that we need to engage and develop a relationship to our own inner masculine. We need to kiss the inner prince. Women need more of the focused, impetuous determination that would allow us to scale the overgrown walls of our own hopes and dreams. How many women do you know who used to paint, write, act, run, march, or go to school, but gave up these endeavors because the lives of those around them were so much more important? Have you done this in your own life? I have. And what do we learn from the stepsisters in the Cinderella story, who cut off a toe and a heel in order to try to fit the glass slipper? What about you or I? What parts of ourselves, our very soul print, have we cut off or abandoned in order to fit in or find love? There is another grim fairy tale called The White Bride and the Black Bride, which talks about what happens when a woman travels too far into good and virtuous archetypes. In this tale, a beautiful young woman is summoned by the king to be his new bride. The white bride is naive, trusting, good, and virtuous, but on the way to the wedding, a split occurs. Now there are two brides. She is now accompanied by her dark twin, the black bride, who is self-centered, determined, clever, and aggressive. Every man at some point will meet the black bride. Perhaps it should be part of premarital counseling. The message of this tale is that while we admire the sweet accommodation and beauty of the white bride, we need some of her opposite to assure that we don't get completely absorbed in serving others. The black bride in us won't stand for martyrdom and will fly into fits of rage if we go too long without attending to our own needs. Sometimes she will send us into bouts of isolated depression or just into a vague discontent, the source of which we cannot name. That's the one where our husbands ask us, "What's wrong?" And we say, "Oh, nothing." A woman who is aware of and has integrated a bit of her shadow bride does not have to leave a marriage in order to find herself, because she has kept her core self all along. After the children are grown, she will not fall into despair over her empty nest, but will look forward to developing herself in new ways with her newfound freedom. In 2001, I had the following dream during a time when I needed to integrate more of the energy of the black bride in my own life. My husband had descended into a lengthy depression, and my life became increasingly absorbed in trying to help him. All I tried failed. The fairy tale marriage, which had begun overlooking the sparkling waters of Avalon Harbor, was faltering. I became engulfed in the archetypes of loyal, long-suffering wife, nurturing and school-volunteering mother, and unselfish daughter of the church. My life was saturated with energies of selflessness, devotion, and saintly contribution. In the background of all this goodness, the black bride began to roil. I felt unseen, unwanted, resentful, lonely, and angry. Then I had the following dream. I dreamt that I was wandering in the basement of a castle. I open a closet, and in it hangs Linnea, with her long blonde hair, one of my old piano students who looked and acted like she had walked off the pages of a fairy tale, sweet, good-natured, innocent. She is dead and hanging on a hook. I reel back in horror and am immediately surrounded by swirling, dark, menacing, predatory energies. I am under attack and feel as if I will be possessed or killed by these evil spirits. I am terrified and call upon the name of Jesus and pray to God to save me. This was a powerful dream, and it had a big impact on me. God is in the midst of everything and constantly sends us messages through our nighttime dreams to signal where we need to make changes and how we are out of balance. During this same period, I was reading fairy tales to my son, and I recognized that I was the princess, and the dream signaled the end of my fairy tale. The energy of that dream stayed with me, and I continued to work it. I learned from one of my dream groups that it echoed the Sumerian myth of Inanna. In this story, Inanna, the queen of heaven and earth, decides she must enter the underworld to help her sister, the queen of the underworld. At each new level of descent, she is stripped of her jewels and all her symbols of power, protection, and identity. By the time Inanna reaches her sister, she is naked and disarmed, and the judges of the underworld rule against her and strike her dead. She is then hung on a hook and left to rot. When Inanna does not return, her servants send a rescue party. Help arrives, and she is brought back to life, but she is not the same as before. Now she is imbued with a new wisdom. Before, Inanna was only attuned to delight. Now she is aware of pain and darkness. She has known heaven, earth, and the underworld. She now becomes the goddess of life and love. My dream of the death of the princess heralded a significant recalibration in my life. I had to face my deeper dissatisfactions and begin to engage the questions of where I would find new meaning and purpose. How was I going to passionately engage my life rather than waiting for the king to emerge from his darkness? I had waited in a state of suspended animation for too long. It was time to turn the focus to my own life. I thought perhaps I might want to write something, but I had to face the evil swirlings inside of me that told me that nothing I had to say would be of any interest to others. I began to engage in dialogue with these dark inner voices and created a process that eventually became my workshop, negotiating the Inner Peace Treaty. I decided to go back to work as a therapist, improve my clinical skills, and expanded my work to children and families. I developed some incredible new female friends. All of this because the princess was dead, and I had to get on with my life. Did the marriage survive? Yes, it did, but in a significantly different fashion than its fairy tale beginning. As I began to feel more like a fully enfranchised woman, I became less angry at my husband for failing to live up to the fairy tale promise of endless happiness. The marriage still wasn't great, but I stayed, continuing to find meaning in my own life. One day, a couple of years later, he had a dream that he had been walking beside a woman for a long time, but was unaware that she was there. In the dream, he took her hand and suddenly realized she was me. At that point, we began to re-engage one another deeply as human beings, rather than as projections of a fairy tale longing. This is the work that is emerging for men and women in the new ethos, because consciousness frees everyone. Although at first it is deeply anxiety-provoking for a couple to grow beyond the bounds of hero, protector, provider, and dependent, adoring maiden, transcending these adolescent scripts shifts the burdens and opens up the possibility for a mature relationship and a deep and abiding love. Consciousness allows people to live into their true gifts instead of prescribed roles. We are enlivened as we continue to grow and change. Life brings sparkle to our eyes and keeps passion in a long-term relationship. We must begin with a core sense of self anchored in our archetypal depths and then reach out to another person from there. In a sense, no marriage can be successful until we no longer need it. It doesn't mean we don't want it, but now we have a choice. Our choice of yes really means something. So how do we go about building that core sense of self? Let's look at another fairy tale. What does the tale of Little Red Riding Hood teach us about life? Besides the obvious sexual inferences, what are some of the other strong messages this tale sends? How does it warn us about engaging the stranger or straying off the path? I often wonder what kind of mother would send her little girl out in the woods without some basic wolf training. It reminds me of mothers who homeschool their girls through high school because they don't want them tainted by the world and then send them off to college. Perhaps Red Riding Hood's mother was very sheltered herself and unable to give her any practical wisdom on how to recognize a predator when she encountered one. The story seems to indicate that Red knew something was amiss. "Grandma, what big eyes you have," etc. But apparently no one had taught her to listen to the voice of intuition. The inner voice that was all but tugging at her cape saying, "That's not Grandma, let's get out of here." How are we helping our daughters and the other girls in our lives to learn to listen to their intuition and inner leading? Are we teaching them that important wisdom comes to them every night in their dreams? Do you talk to your kids and grandkids about your dream work? Both my husband and son know that there are few things that please me more than to have them tell me their dreams. Clarissa Pinkola Estes looks at the wolf in Red Riding Hood through a Jungian lens and asks us what our mothers taught us about the inner predator. Warns us that women are all too easily lured into projects and commitments that are not good for us, but are very good for others. The inner predator says things like, "Don't use your money, time, or resource on yourself. That would be selfish. Give your life away." The inner predator also says things like, "Who do you think you are? You can't write a book or start a business. Your dream will never be. It is too droll or too large, too impossible, too silly." Or perhaps the voice will taunt us and say, "You had better give up on love. No one will ever want you. You are too ordinary." And so we try to figure out how to be less ordinary and more desirable. Never mind our own unique beauty or our own personal desires. There is no end to what we will trade for safety, love, and security. And before we know it, the hungry wolf has devoured us again, and we give up what we really want and turn to the fulfillment of other people's dreams. Another important fairy tale, the tale of the red shoes, warns us that when we trade what matters most to us, that which we make with our own hands and heart, for something more socially acceptable, we have put on the enchanted red shoes. Following collective approval will dance us to our death, and we lose the ballet of the soul. At a certain point in a woman's journey, if she is becoming conscious, she will see the extent to which she has been living as a reflection of those around her. She has been checking to see if she is pleasing or at least acceptable. She may begin to feel like Nora in the play A Doll's House, playing at life but not really living it deeply. Now she must contend with another aspect of the inner predator, the negative father complex. This is a significant developmental threshold for a woman. The woman on this threshold knows intuitively the price of crossing it. If she has been living as a daughter to her husband or her boss or to a male mentor in her life, the thought of graduating from her dependence on them will raise a towering dark voice. This dark voice will warn her that if she takes one more step forward, she will be harshly punished. Then a scared little girl inside will begin to plead, "Don't do it. If you cross that line, you'll make Daddy mad. He'll choose someone else to be special. You'll be all out on your own." Around that time, the voice of the negative mother may start in. You should be ashamed of yourself. Are you a fool? You cannot go out on your own. A woman needs a man for protection and provision. A woman on her own is suspect. And once again, we begin to quake. Many women never cross the line to graduate from daughter to fully enfranchised woman. When we cross that threshold, we have thrown away the map. Few of us have the gift of a bold mentor who went before and can teach us to navigate by our own inner lights. In finding our way, we will have to take ownership and responsibility for our own lives. We may make mistakes, maybe big ones, and we won't be able to blame Daddy for an unhappy choice this time, because now we are making choices of our own. Doing dream work takes us all to the threshold of our growth and shows us where we have stopped developing. For those of you who have friends who won't come to this conference or join your dream group, maybe this is why. Crossing thresholds is scary, but the more thresholds we cross, the more we learn to trust the process. Our dreams keep supplying inner supporters to coax us onward. Recently, my dreams have been indicating a new direction that I will be moving. I feel a bit tentative about my ability to do the work my dreams are calling me into. A few months ago, I had a dream where two of my greatest teachers came and told me that their foundational work was in place, and it was time for me to carry on from there. They were standing behind me, and both were smiling like proud mothers. Thinking back on the way dreams have encouraged me and given me the confidence to move forward, I remember a dream that I had at the age of 19, which helped me break away from my highly controlling father. In the dream, I am blazing a trail across a beautiful circular meadow. Suddenly, I see a little log cabin on the edge of the meadow, and I know it is my home. When I enter the cabin, I am filled with a sense of pure delight. I live here alone, but I am completely happy. I need nothing and no one. It's a simple dream, but the felt sense of the place was profound. It still carries the energy of delight and expansive wonder and a sense of wholeness I was not yet experiencing at the age of 19. I remember awakening from that dream, alchemically changed. I couldn't tell you why at that time, but I had a sense that I would be okay and that life would work out. Such a dream gave me the inner fortitude to tell my father that I was not going to become a classical musician. I was going to follow a different path. The dream still feeds me today when I question about the trailblazing I am doing. How will it be received? The dream reminds me that if I follow my inner leading, it may look to others that I am off the path, and that is okay. I do not need to justify or explain myself to everyone. The most important thing is that I continue to follow my inner leading and to blaze a trail through my own circle of wholeness. When did I first learn this? At 19. How did I learn it? I experienced it in a dream. Let's look at another limiting function in a woman's psyche, the devouring or negative mother complex. Let's look for a moment at the story of Rapunzel. In the story, Rapunzel's pregnant mother has a craving for a particular kind of green that grows in the witch's garden. Rapunzel's father goes to steal some and is caught by the witch, who extracts a terrible bargain from this foolish father. He can gather all the greens he wants today in exchange for the child when she is born. We do this sometimes in our lives. We mortgage our future in exchange for some immediate pleasure or relief. We abandon our most treasured creative output because we don't want to do battle with fear or doubt or something quite difficult. And so when Rapunzel is born, the witch collects her and takes her away. At the first sign of puberty, Rapunzel is locked into a tower so that no man can ever reach her. The goal is to keep her forever a child and never a fully realized woman. The witch in this fairy tale is representative of the devouring mother who wants to keep her children forever tied and dependent. To make sure her children can never really leave her, she will undermine every dream they ever have, play the martyr, blame them for her unhappiness, even get ill, cutting off every route of escape. In the story of Rapunzel, she is held hostage by this dark mother. But time passes and her hair, one of the great symbols of female sexuality, grows long enough to become a ladder for the witch to climb. In her solitude, Rapunzel begins to develop an inner life. Never curse the solitude that is sometimes unwittingly forced on us. In the quiet, we can hear our soul song. And so Rapunzel begins to sing an outer song, which is overheard by the king's son. Enchanted, he watches from the edge of the forest as the witch utters the password, "Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair." He soon follows, scales her golden braids, and they hatch a plan made by countless unhappy girls who throw themselves into the arms of a boy, hoping they will find everything they have missed: attention, love, nurture, appreciation. They often trade one locked tower for another. When the witch discovers Rapunzel's plan, she cuts off her braids and drives the girl into the forest. She then attaches the braids to the window and lures the prince up. When he finds himself face to face with the witch instead of the girl, he falls backwards into the thorns, where he is blinded, and he also begins to wander the forest. The forest. There are many folk and fairy tales where the characters wander the forest. The dark wood, as Dante would put it. Sooner or later, we all wind up there. The forest represents that scary place where we are truly lost. Nothing makes sense. Life has fallen apart. The old maps don't work. The birds have eaten the breadcrumbs, and we cannot go back to our old understandings or ways of being. Now we must struggle and grow. If we are lucky, we may encounter a wise old man or woman who will give us aid while we are recovering from the loss, confusion, or betrayal that sent us there. In the silence of the forest, we can reconnect with our instinctual selves and our souls. Once we have reconnected with soul, we can navigate by our own inner light, transcend our wounds, and live into a bigger story. We've been talking quite a bit about women's individuation journey, but what about men? Here's an old tale told by Clarissa Pinkola Estes that illustrates what men go through to adapt themselves to collective culture. A man came to Zabo, the tailor, and tried on a suit. As he stood before the mirror, he noticed that the vest was a little uneven at the bottom. "Oh," said the tailor, "don't worry about that. Just hold the shorter end down with your left hand, and no one will ever notice." While the customer proceeded to do this, he noticed that the lapel of the jacket curled up instead of lying flat. "Oh, that," said the tailor, "that's nothing. Just turn your head a little and hold it down with your chin." The customer complied, and as he did, he noticed that the inseam of the pants was a little short, and he felt that the rise was just a bit too tight. "Oh, don't worry about that," said the tailor. "Just pull the inseam down with your right hand, and everything will be perfect." The customer agreed and purchased the suit. The next day, he wore his new suit with all the accompanying hand and chin alterations. As he limped through the park, with his chin holding down his lapel, one hand tugging the vest and the other grasping his crotch, two old men stopped playing checkers to watch him stagger by. "Oh, my," said the first man, "look at that poor crippled man." The second man reflected and replied, "Yes, indeed, the crippling is too bad, but you know, I wonder, where did he get that fine custom suit?" As a man, if you think that molding yourself to the collective expectations of your culture is not costing you, think again. Men pay a profound price fulfilling roles and responsibilities. Most of the men I know walk around with internal hungers they can't even name, which they try to fill with drink, drugs, sex, or more work. Often depressed without knowing it, their suffering is great. If you mention this to them, they will shrug it off. "It's no big deal. It's what a man does." Disconnected from their feelings, disconnected from others, disconnected from the pain in their bodies, they become exhausted, bearing burdens far too great for one person to bear. If men would reach out and connect to each other, they would realize they are not alone. But the very act of connecting would mean that they had developed a feminine function in themselves. Men conquer, they don't connect. James Hollis has done quite a bit of work on the wounding and healing of men. He talks about the fundamental problem. Men have roles, not identities. Many men live in a state of longing for an ideal father who would have somehow taught them how to carry all these burdens. The realm of men is work, war, and worry. Men's lives are governed by fear, fear of not measuring up, not producing enough, of not being strong enough or competent enough, fear of disappointing the women who admire or depend on them. Women today often complain about how constrained we feel by traditional feminine roles and the trade-offs we have made to be with the men in our lives. But we must remember that men are constrained as well by a set of limiting archetypes: protector, defender, good father, provider, patriarch, hero, soldier, son. Marianne Woodman once said that in the marrow of men's bones, they yearn for women who will unabashedly adore them, sustain them, unconditionally love them. The problem is that in handing over their power to such women, they choose to be perpetual boys. Powerful so long as they are adored, broken when the adoration either flips into nagging criticism or realistic appraisal. Terror of abandonment can erupt if their woman moves towards consciousness. In their dreams, the dapper patriarch in the pinstriped suit is often accompanied by a doe-eyed female who intuits his every wish before his command. On the same night, a wild young rebel may take off to the forest, accompanied by a fierce redhead. Integrating the doe-eyed and the red-haired woman in a mature, free feminine is not an uncomplicated process. If we as women would release men from the fairy tale expectation that they protect and provide and fulfill our every desire, it would make it a little easier for them. But in order to do that, we ourselves would need to grow up and develop more of these masculine functions in ourselves. This in itself provokes anxiety in men. If we no longer need them, how will they make us stay? The dilemma is outlined in the story Sealskin, Soulskin. In the story, the seal maiden comes on shore to make a family with the fisherman, but he tries to prevent her from visiting the sea to replenish herself. She eventually becomes so depleted that when she has the chance to go, she never returns. An individuated woman must go to the sea on a regular basis. After she has passed the daughter threshold, if you interfere with her inner work, you will surely lose her. If you support her, or better yet, join her, she will love you forever, because women love men on the journey. Men who refuse the journey often find themselves in the dark wood at midlife, sometimes because the woman they sought to keep the same as the day they married her has just moved on. Let's talk about midlife. The forest is a common place for people in midlife. The actual grace of midlife is that we do become disillusioned. We become disenchanted in the truest form of the word. The magic of youth is over, and we must come to terms with ourselves, our lives, our choices, and our human limitations. By midlife, we have hopefully figured out that the fairy tale is not going to come true. The truth will set you free, but first it will make you miserable. Analyst James Hollis tells us there are three main tasks of the midlife passage. They are, number one, to give up impossible wishes, expectations of magical and unlimited love, provision, or protection. Number two, give up our sense of personal importance and realize we are part of a larger story. And number three, give up the search for the magical other, be it partner, teacher, ideology, or institution. Hollis uses the word magical, but we could just as easily use the word fairy tale. By midlife, it has become fairly evident that we are not going to be rescued by a fairy godmother or Daddy Warbucks. And although we may have wished upon a star, all our dreams are not going to come true. If we have developed a sense of humor and can laugh at ourselves and all our human foibles, we'll probably be okay. Some people, however, are unable to accomplish the three tasks of the passage and become increasingly angry, bitter, cynical, and depressed. In midlife, the person who wins is the one who has done the most inner work. The magic is not in the toys. It is in the depths of our souls. The grace of disillusionment is that it allows us the opportunity to see what something or someone really is, What is real? What is possible? Cherished illusions keep us from the full experience of loving and living. We get stuck in our wishes and our projections and can't see who we are actually dealing with. Or we get stuck in the bitterness and hurt because someone else has failed to follow the script. The death of an illusion can be as painful as the death of a loved one. We go through the full grief cycle. We deny, we bargain, we become angry, we withdraw into a depression, but finally we reach a place of acceptance. At that point, we are free. Despite the message of Little Red Riding Hood, sometimes the most important thing for us to do is to go off the beaten path and into the forest. Several weeks ago, I had a dream of a woman who collects old maps. They are maps from history, some used to plan strategies for war. She studies them with interest. Those around her do not understand her interest in these old maps, but they fascinate her, and she does not care if they do not understand. I understand her interest in these old, archaic maps. I have been carrying this woman around with me. I want more of her grounded, self-satisfied, independent energy. The dream reminds me of the following poem written by Joyce Rupp. Old maps no longer work. I keep pulling it out, the old map of my inner path. I squint closely at it, trying to see some hidden road that maybe I've missed. But there's nothing there now, except some well-traveled paths. They've seen my footsteps often, held my laughter, caught my tears. I keep going over the old map, but now the roads lead nowhere. A meaningless wilderness where life is dull and futile. Toss away the old map, she says. You must be kidding, I reply. She looks at me with Sarah eyes and repeats, toss it away. It's of no use where you're going. I have to have a map, I cry, even if it takes me nowhere. I can't be without direction. But you are without direction, she says. So why not let go, be free? So there I am, tossing away the map, sadly, fearfully, putting it behind me. Whatever will I do, wails my security. Trust me, says my midlife soul. No map, no specific directions, no this way ahead or take a left. How will I know where to go? How will I find my way? No map? But then my midlife soul whispers, there was a time before maps when pilgrims traveled by the stars. It is time for the pilgrim in me to travel in the dark, to learn to read the stars that shine in my soul. I will walk deeper into the dark of my night. I will wait for the stars, trust their guidance, and let their light be enough for me. The number one reward of the consciousness journey is a sense of trust that everything will work out. We have wandered the forest and found our way. We have been dragged into the underworld, died, and been resurrected anew. The prince and princess are dead, and in their place stand two human beings, loving and supporting one another, warts and all. Consciousness frees everyone and makes deep relationship possible. We are not searching for the magical other who will make life worth living. We are living by our own inner lights. When we long to be with others, it is not because we are empty. It is because we are full, and we want to share the treasures of the deep. Who will we be when we are no longer living into old scripts and unconscious roles? Our dreams will tell us who we are becoming. What will we do when we have thrown away the old maps? We will watch for the luminous stars that shine in our souls. They will lead us to our true home, a place where all shall be well and all will be made whole.
Thank you.